Lincoln, Disc 20.
Lincoln's military plans bore equally meager results. After McClellan's demotion, the President and the Secretary of War, neither of whom had any significant military experience, found themselves swamped by administrative detail as they tried to direct huge armies spread over half a continent. Yielding finally to suggestions from both Chase and Bates, Lincoln decided he needed his own military advisor, and he called on 64-year-old veteran Ethan Allen Hitchcock. The grandson of the revolutionary hero Ethan Allen, Hitchcock had become a soldier mainly because family tradition demanded it, and, more interested in Swedenborg than in strategy, he retired from active duty in 1855 to devote his time to religious and philosophical investigations. Summoned to Washington in March, he learned from Stanton that the president wanted his assistance. The next day, Lincoln told him of the pressures to remove the traitor McClellan, as his enemies called him, and explained that as president he was the depository of the power of the government and had no military knowledge. In his sickbed, recovering from two hemorrhages, the general thought he was asked to take McClellan's place as commander of the Army of the Potomac, but he didn't perhaps get the message exactly right. The old general was reluctant. He wanted no post, and he recognized that neither Lincoln nor Stanton knew what they would like him to do. Unwillingly, he accepted a staff appointment in the War Department, where his advice was of little use to either the President or the Secretary of War. Left to manage on their own, Lincoln and Stanton received little encouraging news from any front. In the West, at Pittsburg Landing on the Tennessee River, the Confederates came close to routing Grant's army in the Battle of Shiloh, April 6th and 7th. The timely arrival of Buell's forces helped to save the day. In the end, Shiloh was a great Union victory, but the 13,000 Federal casualties marked this as the bloodiest engagement yet in the war. Halleck blamed Grant for the losses, and there was strong sentiment to have him removed. Lincoln overruled the objections with the quiet comment, "I can't spare this man. He fights." But with Grant's reputation under a shadow, Halleck now took personal command of the heavily depleted Western Army and began a slow and cumbersome march toward Corinth, Mississippi. In the East, progress was no more rapid. Fremont said that he couldn't move until his newly established Mountain Department received reinforcements and more supplies. The president had little to give him because McClellan was taking most of the Army of the Potomac down the Potomac to use in his Peninsula campaign, in which neither Lincoln nor Stanton had much faith. Stanton circulated reports of McClellan's disloyalty, only to declare sanctimoniously that, of course, he didn't believe these imputations on the general. Lincoln said he had no reason to doubt McClellan's fidelity. Yet he told Browning that he was not fully satisfied with his conduct of the war, that he wasn't sufficiently energetic and aggressive. Offering a shrewd thumbnail character sketch, the president judged that McClellan had the capacity to make arrangements properly for a great conflict, but as the hour for action approached, he became nervous and oppressed with the responsibility and hesitated to meet the crisis. Harboring such doubts, Lincoln had stipulated that McClellan mustn't embark on his campaign without leaving behind a sufficient force to make Washington entirely secure. That requirement led to an unsolvable conflict between them. Lincoln was never able to make the general comprehend the political importance of the security of the national capital. McClellan, for his part, failed to convince the president that the best way to defend Washington was to attack Richmond. Before leaving for the peninsula, McClellan, as directed, held a council of war, and his corps commanders recommended that a force of 40,000 or 50,000 men was needed to protect the capital. McClellan believed he was carrying out this directive by stationing 22,000 men in and around Washington and by posting other troops nearby, at Manassas, at Warrenton, in the Shenandoah Valley, and on the lower Potomac, all in close proximity if the capital should be attacked. But he never explained his thinking to Lincoln, and except for quickly passing a paper under Hitchcock's nose, didn't show anybody his troop disposition before he sailed for the peninsula. Stanton, still new in his job and always highly nervous, feared for the safety of Washington and asked Hitchcock and General James Wadsworth, commandant of the forces in the capital, to verify that McClellan had followed the president's order to leave the capital secure. Both agreed that he had not. On April 3rd, Lincoln ordered McDowell's corps, approximately one-third of the army McClellan had hoped to muster on the peninsula, held back for the defense of Washington. After that, there was endless bickering between McClellan and the civilian authorities in Washington. The general found the Confederates entrenched at Yorktown on the peninsula and, as usual, vastly overestimating the enemy's strength, demanded reinforcement. Without McDowell's men, he felt unable to carry the Confederate lines and settled down to besiege their fortifications. Impatiently, Lincoln reminded him that even after McDowell's corps was held back, he had 100,000 troops at his command, and suggested, "I think you better break the enemy's line at once." Furious, McClellan wrote his wife, "I was much tempted to reply that he'd better come and do it himself." Lincoln told Browning that he was dissatisfied with McClellan's sluggishness of action. But he tried to soothe the general's feeling with a fuller explanation why McDowell's troops had been detained. For all his charity, he couldn't refrain from adding a word of self-justification. "You'll do me the justice to remember I always insisted that going down the bay in search of a field, instead of fighting at or near Manassas, was only shifting and not surmounting a difficulty, that we would find the same enemy and the same or equal entrenchments at either place." The president assured the general that he would do his best to sustain the army, and he ended with a warning. "But you must act." Relations between the general and his commander-in-chief were strained but not broken. After reevaluating the forces left to defend Washington, Lincoln detached Franklin's division from McDowell's corps and sent it to reinforce the army on the peninsula. Grateful for this evidence of the president's firm friendship and confidence, McClellan told Montgomery Blair that he was now convinced that the president had none but the best motives. He promised soon to report a success that would be brilliant, although with but little loss of life. On May 3rd, when the Confederates withdrew from Yorktown and McClellan began his long-planned advance up the peninsula, Lincoln decided to move closer to the scene of operations. Accompanied by Chase and Stanton, and escorted by General Egbert L. Veal, he boarded the Treasury Department's new revenue cutter, the Miami, sailed down the Potomac, and the next day arrived at Fort Monroe, where 78-year-old General John E. Wool commanded the garrison. After learning that McClellan wouldn't join them because his army had just defeated the Confederates at Williamsburg and was pushing them back toward Richmond, the president and his associates decided that the time had come to liberate Norfolk on the south side of the James Estuary, where the hulking Merrimack was sheltered, still a threat to the Union Navy. Though the professional soldiers in General Wool's command advised that it was impossible to land troops anywhere near Norfolk because shoals would prevent boats from getting closer than a mile to the shore, Chase was determined to see for himself, and using the Miami and a tugboat, got very near to land. He reported his finding to Lincoln, who had been studying the maps and thought he'd discovered another landing site nearby. Under a bright moon, Lincoln and Stanton sailed in the tugboat right up to the shore, while Chase aimed the long-range guns of the Miami to protect them if they were attacked. The president insisted on climbing out on what Virginians called their sacred soil, and in bright moonlight strolled up and down on the beach. After showing that a landing was possible, Lincoln didn't participate in the invasion the next day, but remained at Fort Monroe attending to other business. That evening he heard how Chase had gone ashore, led the Union troops, and received the surrender of Norfolk. A huge explosion told the president's party that the Merrimack, abandoned by the Confederates, had been blown up. So, Chase wrote to his daughter, has ended a brilliant week's campaign of the president. For I think it quite certain that if he hadn't come down, Norfolk would still have been in possession of the enemy, and the Merrimack as grim and defiant and as much a terror as ever. The episode was of no particular importance, except perhaps to confirm the distrust of professional military men that both Lincoln and Stanton shared. But the president wouldn't allow his little adventure to be used to McClellan's discredit. Afterward, over dinner at General Wool's headquarters, when someone made a slurring reference to the commander of the Army of the Potomac, Lincoln rebuked him. I'll not hear anything said against General McClellan. It hurts my feelings. But McClellan, feeling victory almost within his grasp, was not so generous, and he insisted on reversing some of Lincoln's recent decisions. He'd never liked the corps arrangement that the president had forced him to accept, and now, claiming that it very nearly resulted in a most disastrous defeat at Williamsburg, planned to remove incompetent commanders of corps and divisions. Reluctantly, Lincoln allowed McClellan to suspend the corps organization, though he reminded the general that it was based on the unanimous opinion of every military man I could get an opinion from, and every modern military book, yourself only excepted. He warned McClellan that his actions would be perceived as merely an effort to pamper one or two pets and to persecute and degrade their supposed rivals, and asked whether he'd considered the implications of reducing the rank of General Sumner, Heintzelman, and Keyes all at once. McClellan continued to complain that he didn't have enough men to confront the overwhelming Confederate force. He never ceased asking Lincoln for McDowell's Army Corps that had been held back to defend Washington, though he didn't want McDowell himself, whom he regarded as an enemy, who fed the Committee on the Conduct of the War material hostile to McClellan. Unwilling to leave Washington exposed, Lincoln thought he found a way to defend the Capitol while reinforcing McClellan. He'd have McDowell's corps advance overland toward Richmond in such a way as to connect with the right wing of McClellan's forces on the peninsula. But because he retained a residual distrust of McClellan's judgment, he instructed McDowell to operate not as a part of McClellan's force, but as an independent cooperating army. As he expected, McClellan resisted the plan. He insisted that the reinforcements should be sent by water, and he announced that since he outranked McDowell, that general would, under the 62nd Article of War, have to obey his orders. To make sure McDowell understood his mission, the president went down to Aquia Creek, accompanied by Secretary Stanton and John A. Dahlgren, a naval officer to whom he'd taken a great liking. When they reached the Potomac Creek, McDowell called their attention to a trestle bridge his men were erecting 100 feet above the water in that deep and wide ravine. "Let's walk over," exclaimed the president boyishly. And though the pathway was only a single plank wide, he led the way. About halfway across, Stanton became dizzy, and Dahlgren, who was somewhat giddy himself, had to help the secretary. But Lincoln, despite the grinding cares of his office, was in fine physical shape and never lost his balance. His political equilibrium was not so steady. By the end of May 1862, his administration could point to few successes. In neither the East nor in the West had Union armies succeeded in crushing the Confederate forces. Only in faraway Louisiana, where David G. Farragut ran the fortifications on the lower Mississippi River and seized New Orleans, had there been a clear Union success. The Treasury was almost depleted. After exhausting the possibilities of borrowing, Secretary Chase had reluctantly been obliged to ask Congress to issue legal tender paper money, usually called greenbacks. Like Chase, Lincoln doubted the constitutionality of the measure, but he had no choice but to approve it. In foreign affairs, European powers had nearly exhausted their patience, and as cotton shortages caused massive unemployment and suffering in the textile mills, were coming close to recognizing the Confederacy. In Congress, the president had almost no defenders, and a few Jacobin members of his own party criticized almost every action he took. The prospects for Lincoln's presidency were not good. Edward Dicey, the perceptive American correspondent of the British journals The Spectator and Macmillan's magazine, offered what he felt would be the verdict of history. When the president leaves the White House, he will be no more regretted, though more respected, than Mr. Buchanan. Chapter 13, An Instrument in God's Hands. Whenever Lincoln's plans were frustrated, he reverted to the fatalism that had characterized his outlook since he was a youth. A delegation of Quakers, known as Progressive Friends, who visited him on June 20, 1862, urging a proclamation to emancipate the slaves, found him in such a mood. At first, he bandied words with them. Since he, as president, couldn't require obedience to the Constitution in the southern states, could he be more effective in enforcing an Emancipation Proclamation? If a decree of emancipation could abolish slavery, he argued, John Brown would have done the work effectually. Then, turning serious, he acknowledged to his visitors that he was deeply sensible of his need of divine assistance in the troubles he and the country faced. He'd sometimes thought that perhaps he might be an instrument in God's hands of accomplishing a great work, and he certainly wasn't unwilling to be, he told the memorialists. But he warned them, perhaps God's way of accomplishing the end of slavery may be different from theirs. By the summer of 1862, Lincoln felt especially in need of divine help. Everything, it seemed, was going wrong, and his hope for bringing a speedy end to the war was dashed. In the West, the Union drive to open the Mississippi River Valley stalled after the capture of Corinth, Mississippi, and the key city of Vicksburg remained in Confederate hands. In Tennessee, Buell ignored the president's orders to advance into the mountainous regions, and so failed to liberate the desperate Unionists of Appalachia. Federal amphibious operations along the coasts and on the waterways, which had resulted in the seizure of New Orleans, the Sea Islands of South Carolina, and Cape Hatteras, seemed barren of results, except for endless bickering among factions of liberated Louisiana Unionists who demanded the president's attention. And most important of all, the news from McClellan and the Army of the Potomac was discouraging. The lack of military success blocked Lincoln's plan to unite all the moderate elements in the country in a just, harmonious restoration of the Union. If there were any loyal elements in the Confederacy, they gave no evidence of hearing his promises speedily to restore their states to their place in the Union. In the North, the growing body of anti-slavery opinion chafed at the president's slowness to act against slavery and complained that he was under the control of the pro-slavery border states. At the same time, his plan for gradual compensated emancipation in the border slave states went nowhere. Representatives of those states couldn't see why, as loyal supporters of the Union, they should bear the burden of emancipation, while the peculiar institution was left intact in the Confederacy. Though Congress gave token support, in the amount of $500,000, for the president's scheme to colonize the freed African Americans outside the United States, nobody, other than Lincoln himself, had much faith in this project. Only McClellan's campaign on the peninsula could break the stalemate, but Lincoln failed to reinforce the Army of the Potomac just as it came within sight of Richmond. He'd promised to send McDowell's corps overland to assist McClellan's army, but when it was about to start, he diverted it to the Shenandoah Valley, where Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson had begun a brilliant campaign designed to relieve the pressure on Richmond. Outmarching, outmaneuvering, and outfighting the Union forces in the valley, commanded by Fremont, N.P. Banks, and James Shields, Lincoln's old Illinois rival, Jackson moved north toward Harper's Ferry, and there were reports that Union soldiers were running and flinging away their arms, routed and demoralized, in another Bull Run. Some feared that Jackson might cross the Potomac and threaten Washington itself. Even Lincoln at one point believed the Confederates were planning to take the national capital, and he wrote McClellan, "I think the time is near when you must either attack Richmond or give up the job and come to the defense of Washington." That was, however, an uncharacteristic note. Most of the time, Lincoln saw Jackson's campaign as an opportunity to cut off a Confederate army from its base and force it to surrender. He anticipated that Jackson, after pursuing Banks almost to Harper's Ferry, would have to turn south, and he hoped to trap him on the way back. It was for this reason, much more than for a fear for Washington's safety, that he rushed McDowell's force to the Shenandoah Valley, where it was supposed to cooperate with Fremont's army. Lacking a general-in-chief or a chief of staff, he and Stanton took over the day-by-day and sometimes the hour-by-hour management of the Union armies that were trying to trap Jackson. The president gave specific, even minutely detailed orders to McDowell, to Banks, to Rufus Saxton, the commander at Harper's Ferry, to Fremont. But his plan failed. Jackson's men retreated faster than McDowell's men could come up. Catching the Confederates was a question of legs, Lincoln saw, and he urged McDowell, "Put in all the speed you can." Fremont was of no help because he advanced by a route different from the one Lincoln had ordered him to take and spent 8 days covering 70 miles, while Jackson's men marched 50 miles in 2 days. Lincoln's strategy was too ambitious. To trap the Confederates in the valley would have required the close coordination of 3 separate armies approaching from different directions. Fremont from the west, Banks from the north, and McDowell from the east. And the timing needed to be perfect to catch the elusive Jackson. Lincoln didn't have the experience or the technical knowledge to issue orders that were precise, unambiguous, and authoritative. It was deflating to realize, after his heady experience at Norfolk, that he was a political, not a military leader. Jackson's exploits in the Shenandoah served their intended purpose of distracting Lincoln's attention from the major fighting on the peninsula. Slowly and methodically, McClellan advanced toward Richmond at the rate of about 2 miles a day, constantly complaining that he was facing overwhelming odds, that he was handicapped by heavy rains and impassable roads, and, most of all, that he needed reinforcements. On May 31st, the Confederate Army, commanded by Joseph E. Johnston, launched an attack on the Army of the Potomac, while it was divided by the Chickahominy River. All Lincoln could do from Washington was to send encouragement to McClellan. "Stand well on your guard, hold all your ground, or yield any, only inch by inch and in good order." Though welcome, the advice wasn't needed, and the army fought fiercely in this battle of 7 pines, or fair oaks, and on the second day forced the Confederates back on the defenses of Richmond. In the struggle, Johnston was wounded, and Robert E. Lee became the new commander of the Southern Army. With 5,000 casualties, McClellan cried out for more men, and Lincoln did his best to supply his needs. He ordered McCall's division of McDowell's corps to go at once to the peninsula, gave McClellan control over the forces at Fort Monroe, up to this point commanded by General Wool, who was replaced, and ordered Burnside to make available any troops from his North Carolina expedition that could be useful. But plans to send on the rest of McDowell's corps failed. Shields's division, as the president explained to McClellan, got so terribly out of shape chasing Jackson in the valley that it was out at elbows and out at toes and wasn't able to move. With an army of 130,000 men, McClellan prepared to advance on Richmond as soon as the rains ended and the roads permitted the passage of artillery. On June 18th, when Lincoln gently asked when he planned to attack so that he could better dispose of things, the general responded, "After tomorrow, we shall fight the rebel army as soon as Providence will permit." In private, he resented what he considered prodding by the president, and he believed the report of Alan Pinkerton, his chief intelligence gatherer, that "Honest Abe has again fallen into the hands of my enemies and is no longer a cordial friend of mine." To newspaper reporters at Army headquarters, he spoke of the overwhelming superiority of the Confederate Army and complained publicly of the way he'd been treated by the administration. General Fitzjohn Porter, one of McClellan's favorite aides, helped spread the view that the administration was ignoring all calls to strengthen the Army of the Potomac. He urged the editor of the New York World to raise the question, "Does the president, controlled by an incompetent secretary, designed to cause defeat here for the purpose of prolonging the war?" On June 25th, before McClellan could launch his proposed assault on Richmond, the Confederates ripped into his army. He had completely misjudged the character of the new Confederate commander. Considering Lee too cautious and weak under grave responsibility, personally brave and energetic, yet wanting in moral firmness when pressed by heavy responsibility and likely to be timid and irresolute in action. In a series of hard-fought engagements, known as the 7 Days Battles, June 25th through July 1st, the Confederates forced the Army of the Potomac to retreat back across the Chickahominy and down the peninsula to take refuge under the protection of Federal gunboats on the James River. While the Army of the Potomac was engaged in desperate fighting on the peninsula, Lincoln slipped out of Washington and went to West Point, where General Scott was spending the summer. Old and infirm, the general was still thought to have a good head for military matters, and he was perhaps the only commander on whom Lincoln could rely for disinterested advice. The immediate problem the two men discussed was whether McDowell's corps, now stationed at Fredericksburg to protect the capital, should join McClellan's army on the peninsula. No notes were made of his conversations with Scott, but afterward the general prepared a memorandum for the president that implicitly criticized his recent attempt to coordinate the forces in the valley against Jackson and recommended that McDowell's corps be sent by water to reinforce McClellan. The old general reminded the president, "The defeat of the rebels at Richmond, or their forced retreat thence, would be a virtual end of the rebellion." Learning of the surprise visit, a small crowd greeted the president at Jersey City on his return the next day and trapped him into making a few remarks. His trip didn't have the importance which has been attached to it, Lincoln assured them. Indeed, so far as McClellan's campaign on the peninsula was concerned, it had no consequences at all. Nothing that Scott told him changed his mind, and he returned to Washington with more doubts than ever about the value of military expertise. He didn't send McDowell's corps to join McClellan. Instead, on the day he got back from West Point, he ordered the consolidation of all Federal forces in Northern Virginia, including Fremont's and Banks's forces as well as McDowell's, into the new Army of Virginia, and he appointed John Pope to command it. In a huff, Fremont declined to serve under Pope, whom he outranked, and went on inactive duty. Behind Lincoln's decision was his growing belief that McClellan, for all his undoubted gifts as an organizer, would never fight a decisive battle to take Richmond. With painful anxiety, he continued to read the telegraphic dispatches from McClellan's headquarters, with their repeated excuses for not advancing and their constant complaints. The weather, wrote the general, was impossible. Rains made mud bogs out of the roads and repeatedly washed out all his bridges. Wryly, Lincoln observed that the weather did little to restrict the movement of the Confederates, and he judged that McClellan believed, contrary to the scriptures, that the rain fell more upon the just than the unjust. Still, accepting the information supplied by the detective Alan Pinkerton, the general repeatedly lamented his great inferiority in numbers, claiming that he was facing 200,000 men in the Confederate armies. But Lincoln and Stanton had more realistic estimates of enemy strength, compiled by Generals Wool and Meigs, showing the Confederates much inferior to Union forces. Over and over, McClellan asked for, indeed, demanded reinforcements, and Lincoln patiently explained that all the forces at his disposal were already committed. But occasionally, McClellan's demands became too importunate, and the president's temper snapped. He rejected the general's demand for 50,000 additional troops as simply absurd. McClellan bitterly protested that the government has not sustained this army, and both he and General Randolph B. Marcy, his chief of staff, spoke ominously about the possibility of capitulation. "If I save this army now," McClellan concluded a message to Stanton on June 28th, "I tell you plainly that I owe no thanks to you or any other persons in Washington. You've done your best to sacrifice this army." These final sentences were so mutinous that the supervisor of the telegraph deleted them from the copies shown to the president and the secretary of war, and they were not published until months later. During this anxious period, Lincoln worried incessantly. Stanton reported that he was very tired. He'd lost weight because he felt under too much pressure to eat meals at normal hours. "Well, I can't take my victuals regular," he explained to Dr. Henry W. Bellows of the Sanitary Commission. "I kind of just browse round." Mary Lincoln reported that her husband was getting very little sleep at night. He looked so weary, careworn, and troubled that Browning feared his health was suffering. When he told the president of his anxiety, Lincoln held him by the hand, pressed it, and said in a very tender and touching tone, "Browning, I must die sometime." But in public, the president tried to present an air of calm. "Maintain your ground if you can," he instructed McClellan, "but save the army at all events, even if you fall back to Fortress Monroe. We still have strength enough in the country and will bring it out." New troops were needed, but Lincoln felt that a general panic and stampede would follow a massive call for more men. Consequently, he deputized Seward to go to meet with several Union governors in New York and urge them to supply more troops. "I expect to maintain this contest until successful," he pledged, "or till I die, or am conquered, or my term expires, or Congress or the country forsakes me. On reflection, Seward concluded that such a bleak message would be unsettling to the country, and that it would be better to induce the governors to petition the president to enlist more men. Probably nobody was taken in by the ruse, but the governor's memorial gave Lincoln the occasion to call up 300,000 additional men, so as to bring this unnecessary and injurious civil war to a speedy and satisfactory conclusion. By this time, Lincoln had decided that the kind of warfare McClellan believed in would never defeat the Confederacy. He'd arrived at this conclusion slowly, but for some time his dissatisfaction had been growing. Back in June, for example, he'd overruled the general after a doctor protested that, because of McClellan's orders, Union soldiers were not allowed to use the White House estate owned by Mrs. Robert E. Lee, the healthiest and best hospital location on the peninsula. The physician asked the president, "Are our brave soldiers to die off like rotten sheep there, because General McClellan chooses to protect the grounds of a rebel?" "McClellan has made this promise," Lincoln told the doctor, "but I think it's wrong. He doesn't want to break the promise he's made, and," with emphasis, "I'll break it for him." McClellan, who'd never understood or fully trusted Lincoln, was aware of the president's dissatisfaction. It was easy to deduce Lincoln's growing impatience from his dispatches to the general. Many of them, though couched in friendly, reasonable language, were perhaps written less with the hope of influencing McClellan than with an eye to establishing a record to show that the president had done everything possible to assist an insatiably demanding commander. At any rate, in early June, Lincoln decided to visit McClellan's headquarters at Harrison's Landing and to inspect the Army of the Potomac himself. The evening he arrived, he reviewed the troops, and thousands of muskets flashed in the moonlight as the president rode along the lines. Long and hearty was the applause and welcome which greeted him, one lieutenant recorded in his diary. His presence, after the late disaster, seemed to infuse new ardor into the dispirited army. The dispirited commander of that army didn't share their enthusiasm. McClellan claimed that the soldiers didn't welcome the president and that he had to order the men to cheer, and they did it very feebly. "Lincoln," the general wrote his wife, "is an old stick, and a pretty poor timber at that." Shortly after Lincoln reached the army, McClellan handed him a confidential letter in which he outlined his general views concerning the existing state of the rebellion, admitting that his ideas did not strictly relate to the situation of this army or strictly come within the scope of my official duties. His theme was that the war against the Confederates should be conducted upon the highest principles known to Christian civilization. That meant there must be no confiscation of rebel property, which was part of the stringent measure then being debated in Congress, and, especially, no forcible abolition of slavery. To carry out this constitutional and conservative policy, the president needed to name a commander-in-chief of the army. "I do not ask that place for myself," McClellan concluded modestly. "I am willing to serve you in such position as you may assign me, and I'll do so as faithfully as ever subordinate served superior." The letter was couched in respectful language, and there was nothing insubordinate about it. McClellan had earlier requested the president's permission to present his general ideas about the conflict, and Lincoln said he would welcome his views as to the present state of military affairs throughout the whole country. Nor was the Harrison's Landing letter an unreasonable or extreme document, as some of McClellan's detractors later claimed. McClellan even argued that, while avoiding general emancipation of the slaves, the federal government had a right to order, with appropriate compensation for owners, the manumission of all the slaves within a particular state, such as Missouri or Maryland. But what it did make clear was McClellan's view that the war should continue to be waged between professional armies, with minimal disruption of civilian life. That policy had been pursued for over a year, and Lincoln was convinced that it had failed. He was ready to move on. He read the letter, but made no comment on it, except to thank the general for his opinions. Later he remarked that McClellan's advice on how to carry on the affairs of the nation made him think of the man whose horse kicked up and stuck his foot through the stirrup. He said to the horse, "If you're going to get on, I'll get off." The president didn't visit Harrison's Landing to learn how the war should be conducted. He went looking for the best way to end a costly and fruitless campaign. McClellan was mortified that Lincoln asked him for no account of the recent battles, and wasn't interested in explanations of the army's failure. Not confiding his views to the general, the president merely asked him, and each of his corps commanders, to estimate the strength of the Union forces and the location and condition of the Confederates. He then made the telling inquiry, "If you desired, could you remove the army safely?" McClellan saw pretty clearly the direction of Lincoln's thinking, and he reported to his wife that the president seemed like a man about to do something of which he was much ashamed. "I do not know to what extent he has profited by his visit," he reflected. "Not much, I fear, for he really seems quite incapable of rising to the height of the merits of the question and the magnitude of the crisis." On July 11th, 2 days after the president returned to Washington, he showed just how much he'd learned. He named Henry W. Halleck to command the whole land forces of the United States as general-in-chief. That appointment signaled a repudiation of McClellan and of McClellan's view of the war. It was a decision Lincoln had been working through for many weeks. Clearly, he had had in mind both a change in command and a change in strategy when he visited General Scott in June. Though he told reporters who cornered him on the way back from West Point that his conference had nothing whatever to do with making or unmaking any general in the country, this was a little less than the whole truth. The appointment of Pope had been an early signal that Lincoln was changing his military strategy. The president had confidence in this handsome black-bearded new general, who was the son of an old Illinois associate and had been part of the presidential party on the inaugural trip to Washington. He liked his record. Pope had served well in the capture of Island No. 10 on the Mississippi River, and he had led a wing of Halleck's army in the campaign against Corinth. Doubtless he was pleased that Pope, unlike the generals closest to McClellan, was an ardent anti-slavery Republican. He was a protege of Secretary Chase and the son-in-law of a stalwart Republican representative from Ohio. Even more, Lincoln liked Pope's idea of warfare. Boastful and indiscreet, Pope made no secret of his scorn of Eastern generals like McClellan, who he thought grossly overestimated the strength of the Confederates, and he ridiculed those who believed that strategy was more important than fighting. Finding Pope knowledgeable and articulate, Lincoln was reluctant to let him leave Washington, and during the desperate 7 days battles, informally made him his chief military advisor and aide. Day after day, Pope worked alongside the president in the War Department telegraph office, helping Lincoln interpret McClellan's frequent dispatches and making no secret of his belief that the general's retreat to the James River was a blunder. But Pope grew restive in this advisory role and wanted to take to the field. It was at his repeated urging that the president brought in Halleck, who had also been warmly recommended by General Scott. Freed from his desk job, Pope took up his command and immediately made it clear that, unlike McClellan, he wouldn't fight a soft war. He published a series of tactless orders informing his exhausted and dispirited Eastern soldiers that he came from the West, where we've always seen the backs of our enemies, and promising that he would pay more attention to his lines of advance than to his lines of retreat. Pope ordered his soldiers, so far as possible, to live on the country they were passing through, and he prescribed a stern loyalty oath for all disloyal male citizens behind Union lines, with heavy penalties for evil-disposed persons. The words and the rhetoric were John Pope's, but before he issued his orders, he submitted them to the president, who gave them his tacit approval. As Pope took command, Lincoln's confidence began to return. Bustling and energetic, the new general rapidly whipped his troops into shape, and he projected a direct overland advance against the Confederate capital. Just the strategy that Lincoln had unsuccessfully urged McClellan to follow. Greatly encouraged, Lincoln, by mid-August, was so confident that he told Sumner the Union Army would be in Richmond within 2 weeks. Two days after Lincoln appointed Halleck general-in-chief, he made an equally significant shift in his policy toward slavery. Characteristically, he made no public announcement of either change, and in neither case did he make a clean break with the past. Just as he continued to support McClellan's campaign on the peninsula while he was creating a new army under Pope, so, on the domestic scene, he worked hard for his old policies of gradualism and compensation, even while he was moving toward general emancipation. Committed to his inaugural pledge that the federal government would not interfere with slavery in the states where it already existed, Lincoln continued to urge the individual states, with financial support from the federal government, to adopt a plan of gradual, compensated emancipation. On July 12th, just before Congress adjourned, the president summoned the representatives and senators from the border states to the White House, and again pleaded with them to endorse his plan. Slavery in their states, he pointed out, would soon be extinguished by the mere friction and abrasion of the war. Apart from that, he reminded them, his hand might soon be forced, because anti-slavery sentiment throughout the North is still upon me and is increasing. As patriots and statesmen, they should recommend his plan to the people of their states as a way to bring speedy relief from the war. As you would perpetuate popular government for the best people in the world, he urged, I beseech you that you do in no wise omit this. Oh, how I wish the border states would accept my proposition, Lincoln exclaimed to Illinois Representatives Isaac N. Arnold and Owen Lovejoy the day after this meeting. Then you, Lovejoy, and you, Arnold, and all of us wouldn't have lived in vain. But as he doubtless anticipated, the border state congressman refused to follow his lead, and, with a few exceptions, joined in a long legalistic rebuttal of Lincoln's appeal, questioning the logic of his arguments and the consistency of his policies. Confine yourself to your constitutional authority, was the gist of their message. Even before Lincoln received their predictable response, he was moving toward a new course of action. On July 13th, riding in a carriage with Secretaries Seward and Welles to the funeral of Stanton's infant son, he informed these two conservative members of his cabinet that he had about come to the conclusion that we must free the slaves or be ourselves subdued. Both Seward and Welles were startled, because hitherto the president had been emphatic in rejecting any proposal to have the national government interfere with slavery. Both said they needed more time to consider the idea, but the president urged them seriously to think about it, because something must be done. The idea of emancipation by presidential decree was, of course, not a new one. On the day that the news of the firing on Fort Sumter reached Washington, Sumner had gone to the White House to remind the president that emancipation of the slaves of a military opponent fell within his war powers, and repeatedly he urged Lincoln to act. Fremont's proclamation in August 1861, freeing the slaves of Missouri rebels, was another reminder of what the executive power might accomplish. In December of that year, in his final report as Secretary of War, Cameron had also proposed emancipation by decree. As recently as May, General David Hunter, in command of the Military Department of the South, announced that slavery and martial law in a free country are altogether incompatible, and proclaimed that therefore persons held as slaves in Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina were forever free. Though Secretary Chase insisted that it was of the highest importance that this order be not revoked, Lincoln promptly declared Hunter's proclamation altogether void, as he had all previous moves toward emancipation by executive decree. No commanding general shall do such a thing upon my responsibility without consulting me, he told Chase. But in revoking Hunter's order, a new tone appeared in Lincoln's language. For the first time, he made it clear that he had no doubt of his constitutional power to order emancipation. Whether he exercised that authority would depend on a decision that abolition had become a necessity indispensable to the maintenance of the government. A little later, he observed that he had no legal or constitutional reservations about issuing an Emancipation Proclamation, because, as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, in time of war, I suppose I have a right to take any measure which may best subdue the enemy. After overruling Hunter's proclamation, Lincoln began to think of emancipation as a question to be decided on grounds of policy rather than of principle, and he started to formulate his ideas for a proclamation of freedom. He probably talked over the idea with Stanton in May, and he may have discussed a very preliminary draft of such a proclamation with Vice President Hamlin as early as June 18th. Later that month, in the cipher room of the War Department telegraph office, which the president frequented while anxiously awaiting dispatches from the Army, he asked Major Thomas T. Eckert for some foolscap, because, he said, he wanted to write something special. At the telegraph office, he remarked, he was able to work more quietly and command his thoughts better than at the White House, where he was frequently interrupted. He then sat down at Eckert's desk, which faced onto Pennsylvania Avenue, and began to write. He'd look out of the window a while and then put his pen to paper, Eckert remembered. But he didn't write much at once. He'd study between times, and when he'd made up his mind, he would put down a line or two and then sit quiet for a few minutes. That first day, he filled less than a page, and as he left, he asked Eckert to take charge of what he'd written and not allow anyone to see it. Almost every day during the following weeks, he asked for his papers and revised what he'd written, adding only a few sentences at a time. Not until he'd finished did he tell Eckert that he'd been drafting a proclamation giving freedom to the slaves in the South. During June and July, when Lincoln was drafting an emancipation order, he often played a kind of game with the numerous visitors who descended on him to urge him to free the slaves. The measures they advocated were precisely those he was attempting to formulate in his document at the War Department. If he challenged their arguments, he was, in effect, testing his own. No doubt he enjoyed his little game, relishing the use of his lawyer's skills to make the worst cause sound the best. No doubt, too, he was pleased to retain total flexibility, since these discussions committed him to nothing. Thus, to Sumner, who called at the White House twice on July 4th, to urge the reconsecration of the day by a decree of emancipation, the president said that a general order was too big a lick, though Sumner believed he was not disinclined to issue a proclamation covering eastern Virginia. On reflection, though, Lincoln changed his mind about even that limited measure, because, as he told the senator, such a proclamation might cause Missouri, Kentucky, and Maryland to secede. Besides, it would probably be mere brutum fulmen unless he could enforce it. But by mid-July, he was ready to show his hand. Things had gone on from bad to worse until I felt that we'd reached the end of our rope on the plan of operations we'd been pursuing, he explained later. That we'd about played our last card and must change our tactics or lose the game. McClellan's defeats on the peninsula contributed to his decision, as did the demoralization of the soldiers in the Army of the Potomac and the near mutinous state of some of their officers. So, too, did the growing chorus of anti-slavery opinion in the North and the dwindling trickle of volunteers for the Army, a flow that Governor Andrew of Massachusetts bluntly told the president couldn't be increased so long as he persisted in fighting a war that would leave slavery intact. Especially influential was the passage on July 17th, 1862, by Congress, with virtually unanimous Republican support, of the Second Confiscation Act, a measure that defined the rebels as traitors and ordered the confiscation of their property, including the freeing of their slaves. Lincoln had serious doubts about many of the provisions of the Confiscation Act and drafted a message vetoing it, reminding Congress that the severest justice may not always be the best policy. Only after Senator Fessenden, working closely with the president, secured modification of some of the more stringent provisions, did Lincoln agree to sign the measure. And even then, he took the unprecedented step of placing before Congress his statement of objections to the bill he'd approved. No part of the Second Confiscation Act troubled the president more than the section declaring that, after a period of 60 days, the slaves of rebels should be forever free of their servitude and not again held as slaves. "It's startling to say that Congress can free a slave within a state," he remarked, "for such a statement would directly contradict the Republican platform on which he and most of the congressmen of his party had been elected. Congress has no power over slavery in the states," he told Browning, "and so much of it as remains after the war is over must be left to the exclusive control of the states where it may exist. If power over slavery within the states existed anywhere in the federal government, it was to be found in the war powers, which he believed could only be exercised by the president as commander-in-chief. But rather than confront Congress over the abstract issue, Lincoln decided to accept the bill and to undercut the congressional initiative for emancipation by acting first. His preliminary conversation with Seward and Welles on July 13th had been intended to prepare the way for such action. And a week later, the president was ready to discuss emancipation with the full cabinet. On July 22nd, his advisers didn't immediately realize that they were present at a historic occasion. The secretaries seemed more interested in discussing Pope's orders to subsist his troops in hostile territory and schemes for colonizing African Americans in Central America. And they had trouble focusing when the president read the first draft of his proposed proclamation. The curious structure and awkward phrasing of the document showed that Lincoln was still trying to blend his earlier policy of gradual compensated emancipation with his new program for immediate abolition. It opened with an announcement that the Second Confiscation Act would go into effect in 60 days unless Southerners cease participating in, aiding, countenancing, or abetting the existing rebellion. The president then pledged to support pecuniary aid to any state, including the rebel states, that may voluntarily adopt gradual abolishment of slavery. Only at the end did he, as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States, proclaim that, as a fit and necessary military measure, not as a measure that was just or right, he would, on January 1st, 1863, declare all persons held as slaves within any state wherein the constitutional authority of the United States shall not then be practically recognized forever free. At the outset of the meeting, the president informed the cabinet that he had resolved upon this step and hadn't called them together to ask their advice, but to lay the subject matter of a proclamation before them. and the discussion that followed was necessarily rather desultory. Stanton and Bates staunchly urged immediate promulgation of the proclamation. Rather surprisingly, Chase was cool. He feared an Emancipation Proclamation might be a measure of great danger, since it would unsettle the government's financial position. Emancipation could be much better and more quietly accomplished, he believed, by allowing generals to organize and arm the slaves, thus avoiding depredation and massacre on the one hand and support to the insurrection on the other. Despite his reservations, he promised to give Lincoln's proclamation his hearty support. Postmaster General Blair, who came in late, deprecated the proposed policy on the ground that it would cost the administration the fall elections. Secretary of the Interior Smith said nothing, but was strongly opposed to emancipation. He was already thinking of resigning from a cabinet where he felt increasingly out of sympathy with the president. Seward, who'd been thinking over the consequences of emancipation since his carriage ride with Lincoln and Welles, argued strongly against immediate promulgation of the proclamation. He feared it would break up our relations with foreign nations and the production of cotton for 60 years. Foreign nations might intervene in the American Civil War in order to prevent the abolition of slavery for sake of the cotton their factories so badly needed. More persuasively, he argued that issuing an Emancipation Proclamation at this particular moment, after the severe military reverses experienced by the Union armies, would be viewed as the last measure of an exhausted government, a cry for help. His idea, Lincoln recalled later, was that it would be considered our last shriek on the retreat. With his advisers divided, Lincoln adjourned the cabinet meeting without reaching a decision on issuing the proclamation, though he later told one visitor that he expected to issue it the next day. But that night, Seward's ally, Thurlow Weed, came to the White House and again strongly argued that an Emancipation Proclamation could not be enforced and that it would alienate the important border states. Reluctantly, Lincoln put the document aside. Shortly afterward, when Sumner on 5 successive days pressed the president to issue his proclamation, Lincoln responded, "We mustn't issue it till after a victory."
This ends Disc 20.